Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, you ever notice that moment when some, like, new brand of sneakers or maybe an underground band or even just a weird phrase you heard once suddenly goes from being totally niche to just everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. It dominates the conversation, the culture. It's like overnight.
Exactly. That whole transformation, that sort of mysterious process where something small triggers this massive social shift, that's what we're diving into today.
Mm-hmm. And our guide for this is Malcolm Gladwell's really, really influential book, The Tipping Point: How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference.
Right. And our mission, I guess, is to get past thinking these viral things are just random accidents. We want to unpack the actual mechanics, you know, the blueprint for how these social epidemics ignite and hit that critical mass.
And it's so relevant, isn't it? I mean, if you're trying to launch something, a product, maybe start a movement, or even just understand why things catch on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gladwell gives us this toolkit, and it really challenges that old idea that change is always slow and steady. He shows how you can find that one specific lever to flip a trend into, well, an epidemic.
Okay, so let's start with the man himself. Mm-hmm. Who is Malcolm Gladwell? The guy who basically gave us the phrase, the tipping point.
Well, he's a Canadian journalist. Most people probably know him from his longtime writing for The New Yorker since 96, I think. Mm-hmm. But his background includes reporting for The Washington Post. And you can really see that journalistic rigor, that eye for a good human story in his work.
Yeah. But what makes him different, I think, is that he's not, you know, an academic doing the primary research. He's more of a master synthesizer.
Yeah.
And honestly, just a fantastic storyteller.
Totally. He's like the ultimate translator. He takes these really dense, sometimes, let's face it, kind of hard to read academic studies, sociology, psychology, epidemiology, all that. And he turns them into these really engaging stories, you know, stories about hush puppy's shoes or why maybe you didn't get that tetanus shot back in college.
Huh. Yeah, exactly. And that approach itself is kind of sticky, isn't it? He connects dots you wouldn't normally connect, like how a cold virus spreads and how a new business idea takes off. That's really his trademark.
Absolutely. He gives us this sort of hidden map to the forces shaping things around us. It's a really fascinating way to look at influence.
Okay, so let's unpack the core idea of the tipping point. Gladwell's main argument is that ideas, products, behaviors, they spread like social epidemics. That's his term.
That's right. And the big question he tackles is, well, if an idea is genuinely good, why does it even need help to spread? You know, why do some really worthwhile things just explode and tip, while others, maybe just as good, just sort of fizzle out?
And the key insight, the core of the book, is that it's not random. These epidemics, they always follow three basic rules. These are the things that drive every tipping point, whether it's, I don't know, a fashion trend coming back or a city's crime rate dropping.
Okay, so what are they?
Well, first, there's the law of the few. That's all about who does the spreading, the people involved.
Okay, the who. Got it.
Second is the stickiness factor. This is about the message itself. Is it memorable? Does it make you want to act?
Right, the what? The actual idea.
And third, the power of context. This is about the environment, the surrounding situation, the timing, the place.
The where and when, basically. And the crucial point he makes is you need all three, right? Like a great message spread by the wrong person or in the wrong circumstances, it just won't work.
Exactly. They all have to line up for that tipping point to happen.
Okay, so let's break those down. Start with the law of the few. You said it's about the people.
Yeah. It's basically Gladwell applying that old 80-20 principle. You know, the idea that a small percentage of people often do most of the work.
Mm-hmm. Pareto principle.
Right. So here, a small number of really exceptional people are responsible for getting these social epidemics going.
So who are these few? Are they just like celebrities or influencers, or does he have specific types?
He has three very specific types, yeah. Necessary roles. The first are the connectors. Think of them as like the social glue.
Okay.
They have these huge and really diverse social networks. They know people from all different walks of life. They're masters of what sociologists call the weak tie.
Ah, the weak tie. Right, that's like not your best friends, but acquaintances, people you know casually.
Exactly. And Gladwell uses Paul Revere's ride as the classic example. Remember, Revere and another guy, William Dawes, they rode out with the same warning. The British are coming.
Right, I remember this bit.
But Revere was the connector. He knew everyone, tavern owners, militia leaders, people in different towns. His network was massive and varied. Dawes was brave, sure, but his network was smaller, more closed off.
So Revere's message spread like wildfire because of those weak ties, while Dawes didn't really go anywhere near as far.
Precisely. Okay, so the second group, the Mavens. These are the information specialists, like human data banks.
Okay, the experts.
Kind of, but crucially, their motivation isn't really commercial. They just love gathering information, solving problems, and then sharing it. They genuinely want to help and educate.
Ah, okay. So they're the trusted source, like that guy Gladwell mentions, Mark Alpert, who was obsessed with Consumer Reports.
Exactly. If a maven like him tells you which toaster to buy, you trust it because, you know, he's just done the research and wants to help you out, not because he's getting a commission. They provide the credibility.
Makes sense. So connectors spread it wide, mavens give it weight. Who's the third?
The salesmen. These are the persuaders. They have that natural charisma, that infectious energy. They're good at reading people, using nonverbal cues. They're the ones who convince you to actually buy in, to take the leap.
Got it. So they take the info from the maven spread by the connector, and they seal the deal, persuading the skeptics.
You got it. The connector provides the reach, the maven provides the information, and the salesman provides the persuasion.
Okay, that makes sense. But, like, even if Paul Revere reached everyone, why did people actually listen and act? What made the message itself effective?
Ah, perfect transition. That brings us right to the second rule, the stickiness factor.
Mm.
The message itself has to be memorable and, importantly, actionable.
Right. It needs to stick. And it's not just about being catchy, is it? It's deeper than that.
Definitely not just catchy. It's about actually engineering the message so it resonates and prompts action. Gladwell uses children's TV as this amazing case study.
Oh, yeah, Sesame Street and Blue's Clues, right?
Exactly. Sesame Street pioneers used really rigorous research, even like eye tracking, to see when kids zoned out. They learned how to blend the entertainment and the education bits perfectly to keep kids hooked.
And Blue's Clues took it even further, didn't they? With the repetition, the active participation, searching for clues?
Totally. It wasn't fast-paced. It was very deliberate. They built this structure that actually demonstrably improved kids' retention and problem solving.
Right.
It was stickiness by design, not just luck.
And it's not just for kids' shows, that tetanus shot study he mentions.
Oh, the Yale study, yeah.
Right. Just telling students about the dangers of tetanus, giving them the information, it wasn't enough to get them to the health center.
No, barely anyone went.
But the thing that worked, the sticky part, was giving them a simple campus map with the health center circled and telling them to think about when they'd go.
That tiny little practical thing, the map, the nudge to plan, that was the difference. That made the message actionable, sticky.
Exactly. And that simple map, that change in how the information was presented, that leads us perfectly into the third rule, the power of context.
Right. This one's fascinating. It basically says our behavior is way more sensitive to our immediate surroundings, our environment, than we usually believe.
Yeah, it pushes back against that idea. What's it called? The fundamental attribution error.
That's the one. Bit of a mouthful.
Huh, yeah.
But it just means we tend to blame people's actions on their character. Oh, he's lazy, or she's just rude, instead of looking at the situation or the environment they were in.
And Gladwell argues context often matters more than character.
The classic case study he uses is the huge drop in crime in New York City back in the 90s. He focuses on the broken windows theory.
Right. The idea that small signs of disorder like graffiti, broken windows, people jumping subway turnstiles create this feeling that nobody cares, which then sort of implicitly encourages more serious crime.
Now, I know that theory is pretty controversial. Critics point to other factors like more police, an aging population, the economy. How does Gladwell handle that?
He does acknowledge it's complex, definitely. But his focus is on the disproportionate effect of tackling those small environmental things. Cleaning up the graffiti, cracking down on fare beating.
Changing the context.
Exactly, changing the atmosphere. He argues that those small strategic changes in the environment had this massive outsized impact on reducing violent crime. The context was the lever.
Okay, I see. And another example he uses for context is the rule of 150, Dunbar's number.
Yeah, the idea that there's a sort of natural limit to the number of people we can maintain stable social relationships with.
Hmm.
Around 150.
Right. Think about working in a really big company. Once your group gets much bigger than that, you start not knowing people, maybe office politics creep in.
You lose that community feel, that trust.
Yeah. And companies like Gore Associates, the Gore-Tex people, they apparently figured this out instinctively. They deliberately build a new factory or office once a site got near 150 people.
Seriously, just to keep the group small.
Yeah, to preserve that close-knit community feel. They knew it was essential for trust, for innovation, for people holding each other accountable informally. The context, the group size, was key to their success.
Wow. Okay, so pulling back a bit, we've got the law of the few, the stickiness factor, the power of context. What are the big themes we should take away from all this? How does it apply to, you know, everyday life?
Well, the first big one is just reframing things. Ideas spread like viruses. It makes you see social trends not as random, but as contagious things, needing the right person, the right message, the right conditions.
So next time you see some weird office trend take off, you can think, okay, who was the maven who found it and who is the connector making it spread?
Exactly. The second big theme is context over character. This is a big challenge to how we usually think.
Right. The idea that maybe if you want to change a bad habit, instead of just relying on willpower,
you should focus on changing the environment around the habit.
Yeah.
Make it harder to do the bad thing, easier to do the good thing. Let the context guide you.
Interesting. Less about forcing yourself, more about designing your surroundings.
Yeah. And the third theme, I think, is actually pretty hopeful. It's the power of small, targeted changes.
Meaning you don't always need massive effort for big change?
Right. Radical change doesn't always need huge resources or years of slow progress. Sometimes just finding and tweaking the right lever, the right person, the right tweak to the message, the right change in context can have enormous effects.
It suggests even individuals with maybe limited influence can make a big difference if they're strategic about where they apply that influence.
Exactly. It's about precision.
And Gladwell is just so good at phrasing these ideas, isn't he? Making them stick, ironically.
Totally. Let's touch on a few key quotes or ideas, like the basic definition itself. The tipping point is that magic moment when an idea crosses a threshold, tips, and spreads like wildfire.
Yeah, that captures that sudden nonlinear jump perfectly. It's not gradual, it tips, makes you realize you need to prepare for that moment.
Or this one, summarizing the law of the few. The success of any kind of social epidemic is heavily dependent on the involvement of people with a particular and rare set of social gifts.
Mm-hmm. That really drives home that not all influence is equal. You need to find those specific people, the connectors, mavens, salesmen. If you really want to start something, don't just broadcast to everyone.
Yeah, be targeted. And finally, the core challenge on context. The power of context says that human beings are a lot more sensitive to their environment than they may seem.
That one really makes you think about the spaces we design, the teams we build, the subtle cues all around us. Our environment is constantly nudging us.
So, okay, bringing it down to brass tacks. How can someone listening actually use this stuff? Let's think practical applications.
All right. Well, for business or marketing, the big one is maybe stop throwing money at huge generic ad campaigns.
Right.
Instead, identify who are the real mavens in your field, the trust and review, the bloggers people listen to, and who are the key connectors, the people who seem to know everyone. Focus your energy and resources there. It's way more efficient.
That makes sense. What about, say, education or parenting?
Apply the stickiness factor. Don't just lecture. Make the information simple, memorable, and crucially make it interactive. Require participation, repetition, like Blue's Clues did get them actively involved.
Yeah, make them do something with the information, not just hear it.
Exactly. And for organizational management, like running a team or a company?
Use the rule of 150. Be mindful of group size. If a team or office gets too big and starts feeling impersonal, maybe think about splitting it. Keep things smaller to maintain that trust and cohesion.
It's all about designing the context for success.
Yeah. So reflecting on all this, what surprised you the most, maybe?
You know, maybe it was just how powerful that stickiness factor can be. That tiny change the map with the circle for the tetanus shots being the entire difference. It really highlights how small tweaks, if they're the right tweaks, can have massive leverage. It's not always about big pushes.
Yeah, that's a great point. For me, I think it was the optimism embedded in the power of context. Looking at something like the New York crime example, It suggests these huge, complex social problems might actually be more solvable than we think. Not by changing human nature, but by smartly changing the environment, Fixing those broken windows. It implies we can be much more strategic and effective in tackling big issues.
Yeah, it gives you a sense that change is possible and maybe not always as hard as we assume if we just find the right leverage points.
It really makes you look at the world a bit differently, doesn't it? see those hidden connections and triggers. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.